I'm Emily Theed, author of This Vicious Grace, coming in summer 2022 from Wednesday Books.
And I'm Anna, a teacher and a writer in the Queery Trenches.
And you're listening to Basic Pitches, where we...
Two basic pitches.
Break down the basics of writing and being a writer.
Sorry. This is going to be great. This is going to be a great episode. And I think our giggles is where I'm actually going to start the episode. This is going to be fun.
Okay.
So I am sitting down with Alex Rogers, or Alexandria Rogers, as is her author name. We've already been giggling a lot, as you can tell. It's going to be a great episode. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
I am great.
Oh, good.
Now that we're like sitting down, we've had a very fun morning of time zones that don't make any sense. They don't make any sense.
You know, every once in a while, time just decides to make its own rules.
It's true.
And we are at time's whim.
It is
and
absolutely
daylight savings,
true.
Yes, and daylight savings happens for some countries 1 week and another country another week. And we just get to float along with whatever time decides makes sense to time.
Right. We just get to nod our heads and say, okay, I guess. Okay.
If you say so.
time.
Yes. Yes.
You make no sense. So, Alexandria, Alex, you wrote a book that I have not read yet, but I did read everything I could find on the internet about it, and I may or may not have already ordered it.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you.
No, it's exactly what my middle grade heart needed. It's everything that, you know, preteen, teen me wanted in a book. So can you tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, that's so lovely to hear. Of course. So it's called The Witch, the Sword, and the Cursed Knights. It came out February 8th, 2022. So I'm a bit over a month into my debut year. Yes.
Yay.
And it is a middle grade fantasy adventure about Ellie and Cadman, who are drafted to serve as knights of King Arthur's legendary round table centuries after the mysterious fall of Camelot. And if they don't band together and really discover who they truly are and reforge the lost shattered sword of Excalibur, the world will fall to the same ruin that plagued Camelot centuries ago.
I love this so much. I love when people come with an answer to that question and they're like, get ready. And then they put their like pitch pants on and they're like, I got this.
Like, that's amazing. I've written this so many times.
I bet.
Just you wait for my 2 sentence elevator pitch.
I love it so much. I love that switch. I love that, like, oh, somebody just asked me what my book is about. Whoop.
And then there's a total voice change when people do that as well. Like, I can hear it myself. It's like, oh, well, you know, it's about this. Well, it's actually, it is this meets this in this time period. You just go into a completely different mode. It's very funny.
I love it so much. The one thing I want to like hammer home that kind of like made me do like a double take, I guess, while I was reading it, because the first part that I read about it made it seem like it was like medieval. And then the second paragraph came along and said the word Missouri. And I was like, this is now. Like, these are now times. This is a contemporary.
Yes.
So is it contemporary fantasy? Like, what would you, where are we going with that?
Yes. No, it's a good observation. Good question. So it takes place in our current time period. And the overall premise is that Camelot did once exist. In the Middle Ages, kind of the timeline we associate with Camelot and King Arthur. But everybody knew about him. Everybody knew about Camelot, and it was the greatest empire the world had ever known, until 3/4 of the world lost all memory of magic. And that's when the bubonic plague broke out. And so now back then, those who did remember that magic existed, they went into the fairy lands and created 25 and a half kind of separate hidden little kingdoms around the world. And so nowadays 25 kids are drafted every year to serve as Knights of the Round Table. And one of the main characters is from one of these magical kingdoms, and another main character is from a Midwestern state. It's actually Wisconsin where I grew up, which is
Missouri.
My bad. No, you're fine. You're totally fine.
I'm on the East Coast, and there's nothing but the East Coast states. And then once we go left, I'm like past Tennessee and Kentucky. I'm like, I don't know what's out there. It's no man's land.
It's fine. I lived in LA, and people asked where I was from, and I would say Wisconsin. They're like, oh, like near DC.
No,
it's not. But I lived there, so we can say that if you want. you're fine, don't worry. So it takes place at a current time period. One of the main characters, he's from a made-up town that's very similar to where I grew up, of Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. And the castle where they go to train as knights is in our world. It's not Portal Fantasy, it's all in our world, but just hidden away from sight with kind of magical fairy walls that we can't see separating us from the fairy kingdoms.
I am obsessed. This is amazing. Oh my gosh. I love this. I love this so much. I love because every time I think it's going to go somewhere, like my brain was like, okay, it's Portal Fantasy. No, it's not. It's here. I love things. I think I'm such a fantasy world-minded person, like it has to be somewhere else, that anytime somebody's like, no, I'm going to merge the contemporary world with a fantasy story, my brain short circuits. That's so wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks. I really loved working on it. I loved creating the different magical kingdoms and the rules, kind of how the contemporary society blended with the fantasy. You know, that was always one of my favorite things to read growing up. I really delight in those kinds of tales as well, where you can walk out your door and think, I know that this is real. I know I'm just going to walk outside into a street in Edinburgh, but I could see a fairy. And I think that's kind of an exciting mindset to have when you're reading. So I like creating that for characters and for readers.
I just like, it makes me feel like it's a warm hug. Like, the idea of it's a normal everyday thing. I'm just going to go outside of my house and I'm going to see normal everyday things. But there's that off chance that there's a door. Like there's a thing that's never been there before. Or
you look up and you see a dragon.
Sorry, that's my dream. Hi.
I know, right? Whose dream? Who does not have that dream, right?
Right.
Fantasy nerd does not look to the sky someday and think, okay, but what if that shadow is really a dragon wing?
Right. What if? Like,
what if?
I live for that day. I live for that day.
Me too. I'll text you when it happens to me.
Oh, please do. Please do. We'll just have each other on standby. Like, not today. Maybe tomorrow.
BTW, dragon wing sighting.
This cloud is kind of shaped like a dragon, still waiting. Can you talk about like where this world building kind of came from? How did you construct that? Because that is something that is super apparent with this, like, and it is middle grade fiction. With this middle grade book, like how did you go about developing that? Because it is very intricate, the 25 kingdoms, the what can be seen and what cannot be seen, the historical aspect of it all, like, break that open for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess kind of in general, when I do any fantasy world building, it will often come from a glimmer of some concept, some idea, right? And that's probably true for most people. And I think for me, one of those kernels that started this was an actual fact that in our world, people blamed witches for the bubonic plague. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. What can we do with this? And I already had this idea for this Camelot Arthurian world. And so I kind of just extrapolated that and thought, well, say it were true. Say witches really were responsible. Why? And what did that mean for any of the witches who exist? And so one of my characters is a witch, and it's completely forbidden, and she's really ostracized in society. And so that piece of world building, that tiny little detail, ended up defining an enormous part of the world at large, and this one girl's a really important arc where she kind of learns to love and accept who she is. She can't change being a witch. She's always been a witch and always be a witch, no matter who deems it's acceptable. And so that ended up blending into the world itself. And so I think that once you have a few core tenets like that to kind of anchor a story, it's easier to build off of that, right? So any kind of mythology, any lore kind of that happens historically, once you have a few kind of ground rules, like, okay, people don't like witches and people think witches cause the plague and people forgot all about magic because of witches. Therefore, this king could have had an issue with this other ruler because of this other evil witch, and maybe this other witch was put in a tower and she wasn't evil at all. And then what happened from there? And then it can kind of spider web like that. So that's how I tend to do it. And it's very much a spider webby kind of approach.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is helpful, if this is answering your question.
Absolutely. I sometimes on this podcast, and I've talked about it before on the podcast, where I have this moment where I just kind of like key out because my brain is like learning and it is processing that information. And I was doing that a bunch right there because I like to think about my own process and I kind of apply what somebody's saying and say, do I do that? Have I done that before? If not, how can that serve me now? And that, I think that's such a fascinating thing because I hate I used to hate the idea of like sitting down and world building and starting a story from scratch because
interesting.
It's magical that anything is possible, but then it's also terrible because anything is possible. And
interesting.
Yours bridges that gap of like, okay, once I have these like tenets, like I think you called them like the four pillars. Like what did you, I forgot the phrase, but like these tenets, like you have these rules.
But they anchor the story.
Yes, that anchor, exactly, that word. I love that because that floating, I don't like the floating in nothing. I like to be anchored. And once you find those anchors, then you can start asking those what if questions. And I think that's brilliant, 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 brilliant.
Oh, thank you. No, I think that's such a good point because I think a lot of people are intimidated by fantasy because it just feels too expansive when anything can happen. Anything can happen. And I think that that could be scary to find your own parameters. So I think that what you're talking about, I bet a lot of people experience and it feels very common. So yeah, I think having even just practicing with a made up rule, you don't even have to like it, you know, but like anybody can write a short story just thinking, okay, the rule for this world is that clouds always bring firestorms and that's the only magic in the world, but like you just come up with like one yeah. specific thing and then kind of craft around it. So wow. I think that's helpful. I also read sorry. Once oh sorry
yeah no I love this no I love because that's something I've been on a journey to do is like come yeah. up with concepts and come up with ideas because I've always been a one idea kind of person. And I'm like, I know that's not a good way to be. Like, I think you should have some ideas in stock. And I think just playing around with it, like making it, and we're going to get to this because we talked about this earlier about playing with things, right? Playing with ideas. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but that's just so brilliant. It's just saying, okay, the rule is now write a story.
Yeah. No, I thank you. I think it's a helpful way to, it's almost like having Hansel and Gretel's breadcrumbs. Like it can help you just kind of know your own path through a story a little bit better. And I was just going to say that I read once that one of the reasons J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings, was so brilliant was because he created worlds and then demolished them in order to create backdrop. And I'm sure it was written in slightly different language than that, and I wish I could attribute a quote to that. But I thought that was fascinating as a concept that he, and he did. I'm rereading it right now, just kind of for context, and he really did. It's like Strider and Frodo right now kind of wandering the hills, and there's like a two paragraph montage about this war and the people who fought in it and why it mattered, and it doesn't really matter anymore, but we know that these stones are burnt because of it, etc., etc. And there is a thing as too much detail, but I think for a writer, it's real, that can be a really helpful exercise to kind of think, okay, I have this land, whether it be in our world or a completely made up one. And yes, these characters are passing through it right now, here in this time, in my own time frame. But what happened before then? And even just coming up with a few stories can, I think, help create obstacles even. You might go, oh, well, it makes sense that 300 years ago, this could have happened, and therefore this part of the forest is haunted. Or whatever it is, you know? So I think that that can create a lot of depth.
I love that. It all kind of ties back to a lesson that I've learned recently, which is to go back. My advice for a lot of people and that I've taken in is to go back as far as you can with something, or go as like during like Pitch Wars, my mentor was like, go as like almost primal as you can. So if it's something about a character's fear, how far back can you go with that fear, and how specific can you make that. Right? Like how, that's if it's a brilliant. Thing of wanting them to have like utmost control, if it's a character who wants to control everything, go back as far as you can in their childhood, and maybe even go back to their parents, maybe go back to their grandparents. Yeah. Where did that come from? And go, you know, go as small as you can. And I think that's on a world building level, creating, I love that idea of the backdrop, because it's, you're right. I mean, being a Lord of the Rings like nerd. Yeah. I think that's what makes it feel so lush and alive. And yes. I can kind of tell that's what you did with the Arthurian like fantasy, right? Like,
oh, thank you. That was my goal. I had it in the back of my head, and we'll see, you know, it's everybody will take whatever they take from it. But that was something that mattered a lot to me writing it, was making it feel lived in. Mm-hmm. And I agree, I'm a complete Tolkien nerd, and because it feels real, it feels lived in, it feels like people really have been traversing those lands for many, many years, and we're just capturing a snapshot of a journey. And that's what I love about really great fantasy worlds, where it's, you can tell there's this enormous scope, and you get this little glimmer of it, and it makes you want to learn all about the rest of it. And I love what you said about the character arc building and going back to the beginning. I think that's really good advice.
Right. It's something that's helped me a lot in developing a new idea. And I'm going to take that for world building too, because world building is the next thing I kind of want to conquer, is to make it feel lived in, because that's like the ultimate goal for me as well.
Yeah.
How do I make this feel like it's bigger than these pages that I've written?
Yeah. No, I think that's beautiful. I love that.
That's fantastic.
So I can't wait to read your fantasy world building stuff.
Oh my gosh, we'll see. Where it goes. Yay. So I imagine you figuring out this world building process for you did not happen overnight. Can you talk a little bit about like your journey to get here with your fantastic middle grade book?
I absolutely can, and it's funny you say that, because I used to use world building as a crutch and as a wonderful method of procrastination. So I first thought of my middle grade debut over a decade ago. It was Christmas morning, 2010, it's about to be 2011. And I had a dream, which is so cliched, but true. I had a dream about the fall of Camelot, and I saw it very kind of specifically, very detailed. So I knew the next morning I needed to write a story that took place after Camelot. And I grew up adoring Camelot stories and then kind of infuse them into my life.
I love that so much.
Thank you. My mom and I read them together a lot growing up, and she adores Arthurian tales, and I think that it was just very much kind of in my mind, in my heart. But I think I wanted to know what would happen next. So I knew Arthur well, I knew Guinevere, I knew all the main characters, and I was curious kind of if that were true, what then once Camelot fell? Nobody ever really explored it in a way that satisfied my questions. And if they have, I just haven't read it. There could be something brilliant out there. Right. Never know. But I knew that that book was calling me, and I sat down to write it, and I got through maybe 50 pages. And then I thought, I can't do this until I have my anchors, until I have the rules of the world and all of that stuff that we've just been talking about. And then I spent years world building. Because I think I just got really stuck. You know, I was only 18 at the time. And I know there are authors out there who are in college. It's really incredibly impressive. But I was, I think, a bit too, wasn't necessarily self-conscious. I just don't think I fully, I think that I knew how badly I wanted to be an author. And I knew how badly I wanted this book to sell. And I was afraid of the fact that I'd never written anything before. And I knew that the first thing I wrote would probably not be very good. And so I think that I really stalled in writing it because I knew it would be trash. And because you have to go through that, those phases of, oh, I wrote something and that's amazing. And you should be so proud of yourself. And also, edit. And I think I was just so afraid of failing as such an A+ student who had to do everything perfectly growing up that I think I really stalled for a long time. And so I learned to world build very well. I got real good at it. I just didn't write a whole lot.
It's so funny because I'm giggling a lot over here because no one on, I don't know what order these will come in. I don't know much about the season of Basic Pitches, except for it's going to be there and it's going to be great and amazing. But I just sat down with Kat Bakewell, and we both had a conversation about how we were A+ honor students and how that's kind of created like crippling anxiety and like, I have to do it and it has to be great and it has to be perfect and you have to dwell on it. And you mentioned that like A+ student, gotta work on it, gotta make it perfect like that. It's so funny. We had that conversation. So anybody listening is going to be like, wait, they just talked about this. Like, are all authors this? No, they're not. But we've collected
but when
each
you
other.
Are, you know it. No, and it's such a it's funny because I remember writing on resumes for random internships I was applying to when I was 18, 19. Like, I'm a perfectionist, like thinking that was a good thing and having to unlearn years of conditioning. It's like, oh no. Oh no, this is crippling. Let's not do it this way. But yes, so world building actually became very natural for me. And it's never really been an issue for me since. And I'm sure there are people who will read my work and disagree, and that's okay. Like, it's so deeply subjective. But for me and how I personally feel about my writing, world building is almost instinctive at this point. It's the plotting is a lot harder because I took so long to force myself to sit down and write. And when I did, it was really bad and I had to revise it and then it didn't go anywhere and I moved on to a new book. So it's that fear was kind of, on the one hand, it that did manifest, but it also eventually did get published many years later. So it wasn't entirely founded either.
I really, I think the thing that I really enjoy about this is something that I have felt and I know other people have felt, which is the, I don't want this book to be my first. Like, you know, a book that you want to be published, right? Like, you know, a thing that's, I guess let me reverse engineer it. There have been books that I've written that I'm like, I really don't want this to be the first thing I publish. There's something about a story that it's like, I know this isn't good. This is just a learning tool for me. Like I learned, this was a learning process. It taught me what I needed. And this mm-hmm. is the book. Like the, you get projects that you're like, if this one became the first one, this would be great. And
yeah.
I love that you even had the knowledge of that. Like, I want to spend time on this. I don't want this to be rushed. I don't want this to, you know, be written and then, you know, die in the query trenches or whatever. Like you want to yeah. give it your its best. And I think that's being cognizant of that is fascinating and so wonderful because I am devil may care with things. I'm like, nope, just gonna write it out. And if it grows somewhere, great. If it doesn't, great. And then just move on. And then I'm sad later. So knowing that you were cognizant of that is so cool to me.
Thank you. It's interesting though, because I think that you can definitely get in your own way with that mentality. You know, as I said, I thought of the book in 2010 and I didn't really, and I wrote parts of it, but I didn't really write it and finish it until 2015. And so I think that when you're that attached to something, you'll slow yourself down most likely. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's journey is different, but I definitely slowed myself down. And part of it was just life and me being young and like a young 20 something and moving around to multiple cities and kind of finding my feet in the world and finding myself. And so not all of the timeline was due to that insecurity. Some of it was just a natural, I was getting my master's degree at the same time. Yeah. There's other things happening, but you can really slow yourself down by being attached to one thing being the book that you publish. And uh-huh. I'm really grateful that this one did eventually get published. But I also think that there's something to the idea of trusting the process and kind of trusting, you know what, if you really love something and really believe it will get published, it probably will. You just maybe not on the timeline that you expect, mm-hmm. you know, like it, things that you shelve don't necessarily remain shelved forever. And, you know, with The Witch, the Sword, and the Cursed Knights, the book that eventually got published is extraordinarily different from the one that I originally wrote. The one that I originally wrote was Portal Fantasy. It's a completely different kind of construct now. And so
yeah.
sometimes shelving it can be so disheartening, but can really be for the best because you grow as a writer and you learn, and maybe you have your fourth book get published and the one that you absolutely loved you go back to and edit with all the new tools you have, and it becomes the eighth book that you publish, and it's so much richer for it. You know, it's, we have right. no idea what our process will look like. It's so up to the fates of writing.
It's so you know? True. It's so true. We're all so different, and we all have like that gut that tells us different things, right? Like it'll tell me yeah. something different. It'll tell you something different. And I really want to talk about this because Emily gives me a little bit of flack because I am notorious for querying a book, like 10 agents, and then being like, nope, it's not ready. And then I stop querying it. Like very notorious. I've done that about 2 or 3 times at this point.
Okay.
And I just know in my gut that it's not ready. Or yeah. there's something with it that I'm like, it's not, I need to change something, but I don't have the tools for that yet, or I don't have the brain space. And I kind of like, she teases me about it, but I'm like, no, really, it's not ready. Like if I handed that book to any of my writing friends now, they would be like, what is this garbage? And I'd be like, I know, right? How do you know? I mean, what is that process for you where you know something's not right yet, like it's not ready yet, or you're not there yet for it? And I think it's kind of interesting too, because it ties into a little bit of V.E. Schwab talks about this with Addie LaRue. Like she had Addie LaRue in her head for like 10 years, like just feeding it a little bit at a time. And I still don't quite understand that process of how do you know when it's time? Like, how do you know when it's ready? Or how do you know when to put a project aside to focus on something else?
Oh, it's such a good topic that we can just dive into for hours if I wanted to. There's so much to unpack there. I didn't know that about Bea Shaw and Addie LaRue. That's fascinating. That's really interesting. I actually, that one's on my bookshelf. I really want to read that one. I've been dying to for ages.
I will fangirl about that book for forever. It kind of hits on the whole, like, the world feels much bigger, and it feels like the mythology in there is so much bigger, but we're just getting a very small story. And I think it is that whole letting it sit for years and years and years and just kind of like feeding it. And I don't know, just anything we can talk about that. And obviously, I think the caveat before we dive in is whatever we say here is your process, or it is my process. And there are so many other processes. So
absolutely,
whatever.
Le process. I think that for me, I know that I'm not ready to write a book when I've spent some time with the characters and it's not clicking. And so I will often have a spark of an idea or a spark of a character voice. It's kind of one or the other. It's normally a concept, though. It's normally just a what-if kind of concept and maybe a blurry image of a character. And I will start writing it out. And I learned this, by the way. Like, I used to, like, struggle and try and force myself to finish every project that I started, and learned that for me personally, it was a very unhealthy way of doing things, because it just felt like self-punishment. Like, if I don't, I'm only at, you know, I've already made it to 25,000 words. I can't believe I can't make it to the end of this book. What's wrong with you? You know you can do this. You've done it before. All this very negative self-chat. And I would kind of like eke out every word, and I would end up hating the project and not look at it again. You know, it was detrimental for me. And I know people who say you have to finish everything you start. And I think that, and I had that in my head, and I think that that is a really valuable process for some people, you know, but not for me. And so I think that the first thing about this, which is it's very unrelated to books at all, but it's just knowing yourself and knowing kind of what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and kind of learning your own rhythms, because you can help stop yourself from going into a more, you know, negative self-chat, kind of self-punishment. If I don't write 7 hours a day, I'm not a real writer, whatever that looks like, versus writing 7 hours a day is what I need to feel fulfilled in my day. There's nothing wrong with writing 7 hours. It depends on the motivation behind it. And and so I think that that's true with the projects you decide to let go of and the projects you decide to hold on to, the ones that you shelve knowing that was just a learning experience, the ones you shelve knowing I'm going to go back to that. I think this is much more about just like life than books, but I think it's just a process of getting in touch with your intuition. And I literally have a process that I do where I write out, like, my brain will be filled with random thoughts, right? Like, and my mind can really get in the way of my intuition on something. And so I'll just write out all of my kind of cluttered thoughts and what I'm afraid of and what I think, like, what it makes me think about myself and kind of all the stuff, you know, the meaningless stuff. And I throw it onto a page, and then I sit and just like breathe for a few seconds. And then that honestly has helped me kind of dig a bit deeper into what my intuition is saying. And it's like, I've been able to kind of expel some of the random silly fears and concerns and all that kind of stuff and go, okay, my gut's saying this is not the right book. And the only reason I'm working on it is because I think I should, because that's what the industry's told me, or whatever. Like, it just helps me unearth motivations behind things. That was a lot of me talking there.
No, I love hearing about other people's processes, because it gives you a tool that you can use, and it makes you like feel like, okay, I do that a little bit. Like, I'm already doing a little bit of that. And my hope is that people who listen to this, if they aren't already doing it, it's something that they can try, or maybe they are doing it, but they're doing it a different way. I think that is so, the more I learn about craft and the more I learn about the act of writing and being a writer, bunny quotes around that, because mm-hmm. who knows what that looks like. I think the more I learn about it, the more being a writer is just knowing yourself and knowing your own process. And we can't not talk about it, but like Brandon Sanderson doing his whole Kickstarter thing. And he's like, I wrote 4 books in a pandemic. That works for him. That's great. That's his process. And is that what makes him fulfilled? Fantastic. Maybe your thing of feeling fulfilled is not writing 4 books in 2 years. It's writing 1, or maybe it's writing 1.5, or maybe it's writing mm-hmm. 3 projects that you don't finish, but you learn something along the way. I love that it's doing things with intention. Like you said, it's the motivation behind it. Why are you doing that? Like, intent, is this intentional? Like, even though you wrote those books and forced yourself to write part of those books, you learned from that process. I can't do that. That's not how I work as a creative person. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, I think going through that was grueling, and in the beginning of 2020 as well. but really important to learn your own limits and parameters and what you need to feel fulfilled as a creative individual. Mm-hmm. And as you said, that's different for everybody, and that's okay. And you know, it's the same goes for quitting something. You know, the word quit has such negative connotations, but mm-hmm. we could mm-hmm. go into that for a long. I've done a thing lately where I'm sort of relabeling things, where I like, because I'm just like, I'm tired of using this word because there's too many associations. I'm going to call it something else. And right. I think that quitting needs a new word, a new label, because like, especially again, for those honors students, quitting is basically failing, which is failure. Your entire self-worth imploding.
yes we are, like, on this podcast we try and get people who like have similar mindsets, in the sense of it's not the late, like, quitting is not a negative thing. It's part of the process, and everything is part of the process. And mm-hmm. I would be remiss not to mention our dear, dear friend Kale Bird, who had the idea that it is not a rejection, it is a pass. And, you know, it's relabeling those things so it takes that negative connotation out of there. I would love to find something that quitting is not a negative thing. It is, it's just part of that process, because I agree. As soon as you said quit,
moving on.
Right?
Like, okay, you end a relationship with somebody who's not, like, a friendship or a romantic relationship with somebody who you're not in alignment with anymore.
And it's a mutual breakup. Like, I went through a mutual breakup with like, this book.
I moved on with my life, okay?
I sought a better opportunity.
This was about self-love.
I had a growth mindset.
Why can't it be the same? I ask you.
Oh, I love this so much.
Yeah, so we can relabel. And I think that what we're talking about with motivation, it's the same for moving on from a project. where you, it's a, if I have almost moved on from projects because I didn't think I could do it. And that's not a great motivation for me. Like, I don't want to quit something because I'm afraid that I'm not going to do it very well. And I've had really good critique partner friends who said, you need to stick with this. One of my friends texted me something like, I'm already obsessed with this. I have to know what happens. I promise you, you're able to do it. And I pasted that on the document. And so I could look at it every time I went back to work on it. And so I think that, again, just knowing why you want to make the decisions you want to make is so valuable. And knowing that there's no wrong and right. It's not bad to quit. It's not bad to stay. It's just about, why are you doing it? And so I have stopped working on multiple projects because, as I said, I've been able to figure out when it's going to click and when it's not. And for me personally, in my writing process, character comes first. Like, I had the story idea, but then as soon as I start writing, I have dialogue and I have inner monologue, and everything else I put on top of it. But the skeleton first draft that I have. It's always, you know, it's skeleton first drafts are really under, and then I overwrite in my second draft. But my skeleton first draft, it is pure dialogue and inner monologue. And so if that's not coming through, I go, okay, this is a really good story concept. I will come back to it when I feel like the character is vibrant enough, but right now it's not. And I did that really recently for something. So I think it's just practicing this until you learn what those specific things are for you. Because I have a really good friend who does character last. That's just, she does plot first. And so it's, you know, so like my process, if she went by what I did, she'd never finish anything, you know, because it's not correct for her. So it's really just that practice and knowing yourself really well, which I feel like is hard advice because you're just like, oh, but I want to just do what that person's doing and follow that template. But we all get to create our own templates.
Exactly. Oh, I love that. There's going to be so many good quotes to like advertise this episode with. And I'm very excited. About that. I'm like cataloging them in my brain. Like, ooh, that's going to be one. We'll come back to that. But you're so right. Like it is, it's almost like, you know, I talk openly about like going to therapy. And one of the things with therapy was like learning yourself and learning those triggers and learning those anxiety things. And I've learned to adapt that with writing. So if I get to a point where I'm stuck, like that's why I don't believe, I'm one of those people who don't believe in like writer's block. I think it's just a thing of something isn't working. You haven't found that spark. You haven't found that thing that clicks. And I love that that thing that clicks can be anything. It can be plot for one person. It can be character for another. It can be world building. And you know, when you get to a point where it's just not happening, the words aren't coming, that means something is fundamentally not working and you need to uncover that. You need to spend some time. You need to pause drafting and go back and find out what it is. Like, what's that thing that's not working? And it's okay. It's okay if, you know, you're not speed drafting a thing in 30 days or 3 months or 6 months or whatever. It's all part of your own specific process.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And it's actually funny you mentioned writer's block because I do think there's a difference in leaving a project when you're 15, 20,000 words in, 10,000, 15, you know, when you kind of reach that point where you're like, I know a bit about this world, but it's just not working and I'm going to leave it for another day, another month, another year. That's kind of between 10 and 20,000 words is kind of where I will really leave a project for a while. But once you're, for me, once I'm like 60,000 words into something and I have writer's block, it's, the answer generally isn't, this isn't the right project. The answer is generally something else is not clicking versus this is not the right project for me. You know, and I think it's funny you mentioned therapy because I've realized with my own therapy that oftentimes the writer's block has nothing to do with the book. It's just my own stuff.
Yep.
You know, it's like, I'm afraid of being successful. I'm afraid of being unsuccessful. It's like my own insecurities that kind of get in the way, and block me. And so I think learning to kind of be at peace with myself a bit has actually helped that quite a lot.
Yeah. I think there's a difference of like you're sitting down to write and the words just aren't there because your mind isn't there. Like your mind and your heart aren't there. I think when it's like this story isn't cooperating, like that kind of thing, like, yeah, but that just means you need to go back and help it cooperate. Like you need to find the sparks that make it cooperate. And like, that's okay. Like, I think that's a totally different thing than, I don't know. I'm still figuring out that relationship. I love, it's that when your brain isn't there, when your heart isn't there, the book isn't there and that's okay. Like you can come back to it another day. And the other thing that was kind of interesting that you brought up is the different, I think we're all familiar with the like early block, right? Like the 10K, 20K, 25K for some people. Like they always get there and they're like, whoop, shiny new idea. And then this one becomes difficult. And then we go to a new idea versus the 60K or the later part of the book past that midpoint or at that midpoint. I think when a block happens there, you've made it so far, the idea has merit. It's a different kind of block. It's a different kind of you shouldn't give up, which is interesting. I've never thought about that.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. And it does feel very different. And I think that with those kinds of blocks when you're much further along and you know you're sticking with the story. The story, as you said, the story has merit. I think that it's getting unstuck from the point of view that you're in. I think I found that to be helpful. I think I read on, you know, Roshni Chokshi, the writer of, she wrote Gilded Wolves and The Star Touched Queen for and Arushan, The End of Time for listeners. She's a really beautiful writer. And she mentioned something on her website about how she changes the point of view of from that she's writing from. And so I think she even used blood as an example, like, and, or the couch or a chair. Like she'll write from the point of view of anything else in the room. And that can help her. I'm paraphrasing a bit because I'm just remembering this from her website. But basically, I'll talk about myself now because I don't want to put words in her mouth. But for me, I've started using that practice and I found it so helpful of just kind of when you're at that 60K mark, right? Like we're with that kind of block, I found it helpful to unstick me from that kind of narrow blinkered path that I can end up on. I think we all end up on when you know the story so well. It's like, it's the, you can't see the forest through the trees kind of problem.
Yes.
And I think that little tricks like that can help you begin to see the forest again. And also talking, you know, talking to my critique partners and like zooming really far out and going back to the overall structure and the overall the overall anchors. I have my kind of main points of a book that my editor and I actually really kind of talked about of, you know, it's in The Witch of the Sword and the Cursed Knights. We had the Academy and the trials they go through and the characters' inner arcs and everything happening with this witch, Crovin. And I was trying to kind of make sure at every turn that all of those threads were getting tied throughout each chapter. And that's another way I think of zooming far out, you're 60K or whatever, and go, okay, what are the main points of my story? How are they connecting right now? So that can be helpful.
Wow.
Keeping that present and with that kind of bird's eye view.
I love, and I'm going to go look for that so that I can find the link to whatever. Is it an article that she wrote or a blog post or something?
I think it's maybe in her FAQs.
Okay. I will look there and then I will make sure to post a link because I love the idea of just getting yourself out of that rut of like, this is the story I have to tell. This is the story I have to tell, because you can get so narrow that you have to remind yourself that you are not that, like, you are not that character. You are the writer and you are looking at a big world and your character that your reader is going to be looking at this book, not this person. And that's, I don't know. That's so fascinating. That's so, what a good, useful tool to have.
It was a great piece of advice. The other thing that I just thought of is when, if you do have writer's block, is going back to the character stakes and at the end of every chapter, and it doesn't always work out this way, but I at least try to have they're but or therefore, right?
Yes.
And so, yeah, character does something, but or therefore, and so I think that's another place when you get stuck. Like, okay, what has my character just done? And what's going to happen as a result of their active choices?
Yes.
And that can help kind of spur more thoughts.
Love it. And that helps. I mean, we talked, again, this is so funny how things keep crossing over. But in that same conversation with Kat Bakewell, we talked about the synopsis and how, you know, you have a lot of reactive characters rather than proactive. And that is also a really great tool to use, is that every chapter is a reaction to or a reversal of something your character has done. The but and therefore, I'm writing that down because that's brilliant and wonderful. How does this change the scope of the book? How does this change the next thing that happens? How does this domino connect to the next one? Fantastic.
I cannot take credit for the but therefore. I've definitely read that somewhere and incorporated it into my practice. But it is brilliant. And, you know, I think that it's, your conversation with Kat sounds spot on, because having inactive characters is a really common thing. And I think that can help ease your revisioning when you're kind of catching that during the drafting process.
Yeah. Anything that's about that kind of breaks down the norm of revising while you're drafting is my favorite thing, because I'm very much a person who's like, I know it's not going to be perfect on draft one or draft two or draft three or even draft four and five, but the more I can catch when I'm drafting, the better it will be for my brain, especially those big, you know, anchors of character and plot and world building.
Yes. Yes. I 100% agree. And that's another one of those writing rules that I've learned does not work for me in the slightest. Yep. The never revise as you write rule. I understand why it's there, and I think it can be extraordinarily helpful for people, but I used to be a complete pantser, and that was kind of my idea of not revising. I'm like, well, I just have this book, this idea for a book, I'm gonna go for it. And I always inevitably rewrote the entire second act. like not even like kind of tweaked it. They were cut, paste, dumped somewhere else, new words here.
Yep.
And I got really tired of this, what felt like redundant and slightly wasteful process. And I instead have started kind of writing and outlining and revising all at once, which somebody told me I'm now a chaotic plotter, and I will run with that.
I love it. I love it.
Very on brand. but I absolutely feel like I need to revise as I'm writing, because otherwise I lose the threads of the story. And I go, okay, well, I've already decided that this character instead is going to go on this journey over to the left. We're not going to the right anymore. And so in order for me to keep writing, I have to make these revisions, or at least make notes and outline things differently. And so it all feels like it's kind of meshing together as I create it. And it's, so far, it's helped me create slightly more coherent first drafts that feel like I have an actual story structure that I'm happy with. And I have to go back and revise and change, but the structure feels like the actual story I want to write, and not like a weird mesh of whatever I was thinking of the day I started, you know, sat down at my computer to put words on a page.
That speaks to me so much, because I have been on a journey of being an overplotter. Like, I had to know everything before I started writing. And now I'm like, I tried the pantsing thing and I was like, I can't do this. My words are not good and I don't enjoy that. And that's not fun for me. But I like the idea of it almost seems like you're checking in with yourself and checking in with your ever evolving self. Like, who you were when you sat down to write that outline is not the same person as you are today. And I think that really resonates with me, is like, okay, I'm going to check in with what I just wrote. Does that remain true? Okay. How do I alter things to move on from here? How do I continue to reach that end? Right. I think that's amazing. Like, makes me feel very validated.
No, that makes complete sense. Sorry, you cut out there for a second.
Sorry.
So a little bit of that. No, you're fine. But no, that makes sense. And I'm glad that it resonates. And I think that it's helpful just to have different examples of how to do this. Because there's, as we said, so much, there's not one right way. And having people who do things differently for me as a writer can help me go, okay, that means my weird way of doing things isn't as weird as I thought, and it's allowed and it's valid, and it's what helps things flow more quickly.
Right.
And I think that's what really matters for people kind of across the board, is making sure that they know that as long as it's working for them, the process is valid.
Exactly. This is such a nice way to end the episode.
No.
Like, whatever you're doing, as long as it's working, it's valid. I love that.
Yes, absolutely. Just check in with yourself and make sure it's serving you. It doesn't need to serve anybody else, as long as you feel fulfilled with how you're writing it. And I guess the last thing I'd say is just continuing to honor whatever spark it is that drew you to the story begin with. And I think that's something that we can really easily lose while drafting, revising with the push to get it done and circling all the way back to V.E. Schwab. I remember reading something that she wrote about how writing, and I'm paraphrasing, but writing became it, the focus became on finishing the project, on having a finished project that she could show and not on the process itself. And she slowed down and started writing a lot less per year in order to go back to honoring and loving the process.
Yes.
And that is something I think is a really beautiful example to see such a successful author bringing in, incorporated into her life, and something I know I try and have been trying to go back to myself. It just, this is my process. It's working for me. And one of the reasons it's working for me is because I am enjoying it, and I'm not feeling like if I'm a slave to my words, I'm a slave to my computer. I'm allowed to step back and appreciate what I'm creating and not hurt myself trying to pound out 5,000 words a day if it's not working.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. I love that. It's so freeing. Like, conversations like this just make me want to go work. Like, they make me want to go sit down and create, because you remember why you started in the first place. And
that's so valuable. That's such a wonderful, important thing. And it's one of the reasons I think your podcast is great, because I think a lot of people end up feeling, I feel that way when I listen to an episode. Like, oh, I'm gonna go create, not I'm gonna go write and prove my worth. I'm going to go create something, which is all I really want to do. And I love the kind of rekindling of that.
That's so well, you've added to that in our podcast. Cool. Thank you very much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you. No, it's been so lovely chatting to you. I can't wait to see where all your books go.
Oh, thanks. Before we leave, I want to make sure we talk about this, because you shared with me something that is very exciting. And by the time this podcast comes out, it won't be brand new information, but it'll be still new and exciting. So tell me something that happened with The Witch, the Sword, and The Cursed Knight.
I received the very wonderful and honoring news that Barnes & Noble has selected The Witch, the Sword, and The Cursed Knights as one of their top 6 children's books of the year, and I'm really excited.
Woohoo! That's so exciting!
thank you. The information, it's funny because I actually get to announce it live tomorrow, so technically, this is being recorded. This is a preview.
Secret. It's a secret.
But I was really honored and really, really surprised and excited. And I cannot wait to see where it goes. And I'm actually going home this week I live in Edinburgh. I live in Scotland. I'm going home to Wisconsin to go sign some books at the local Barnes & Noble and also see my parents.
Oh, that's so wonderful!
Yeah, I'm excited.
That's so exciting!
Yeah.
Your character could walk in that Barnes & Noble and buy it!
I think my dad already bought like 7 copies from different places.
What a dad! I love him!
I know. It's like, well, I got one from Amazon, and I got one from Books of Wonder, and then I got one from Barnes & Noble. Like, okay.
What a dad! I love it.
It's really sweet.
Oh my gosh. That's so exciting.
But yes, I'm very honored. I'm almost excited to see who else is nominated. So I believe there are 6. I think last year there were 6. So it's 5 or 6. And so there's different books that are nominated, and then they're going to vote on kind of their overall winner. And there's a category for middle grade and YA, and I think picture book as well. So I'm excited to see who's nominated, and I'm excited to learn more about it tomorrow. But yes, I'm very thrilled.
Oh my gosh. Keep us updated, because I want to know.
I will. Thank you.
I need to know. And I'm going to keep myself updated as well. Just be watching your timeline. Are you on, so people can also keep up and watch for this, and you know, if they can have any say in this, are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. I'm also on Instagram, which I use both. Twitter is slightly more for updates. Instagram a bit more active on. But the handle's the same. It's Alexandria ER_.
Excellent. And I will make sure to have that in the show notes, as well as a link so that everybody else can buy your wonderful Arthurian middle grade book that has been celebrated and nominated by Barnes & Noble. Woo! Again, so excited.
Thank you.
I will give you a chance if you want. We can include this in the episode or not. But usually when we have a guest on this podcast, we invite them to pitch their book very badly or very plainly. Do you have such a pitch?
Okay. All right. Pitching my book badly. So The Witch, the Sword of the Cursed Knights is about a couple of kids who have to find a few pieces of old metal and put them back together. And if they don't, a lot of people are going to die.
I love that so much. Find some metal, put it back together. If not, people will be dying.
Oh, because a dead man said so. That is it.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Basic Pitches. We super appreciate it. Remember that you can pick up The Witch, the Sword, and the Cursed Knights anywhere books are sold. Alexandria Rogers was a delight to talk to, and I hope you enjoyed listening to her. Remember, if you're interested in following along with her journey, you can find her on Instagram and Twitter. I have all the links for that in the show notes, as well as a link to go buy this book because it's really cool. I'll see you next time. Bye, Pitches!